From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They were copying everything flowing across the internet cables and the major internet links between AT&T's network and other companies' networks.
Former AT&T technician Mark Klein, the man who blew the whistle on the involvement of phone companies in the Bush administration's domestic spy program, will join us as the Senate prepares to vote on a measure to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Then a major decision in Canada. A federal court rules sending a soldier back to the United States when he was in that the war in Iraq is in violation of international law and that they would reconsider his asylum claim. We'll speak with the soldier, Joshua Key, and his attorney. Then to Gaza. We'll speak with award-winning Palestinian journalist Mohammed Omar. He was hospitalized after being strip-searched and assaulted by Israeli guards at a border crossing between Jordan and the West Bank. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, at least 40 people have died after a suicide car bomber rammed two diplomatic vehicles outside the Indian embassy in Kabul. It was the deadliest car bombing in Afghanistan this year. Over 140 people were injured. The gates of the Indian embassy were blown off, and the walls and buildings inside the compound were also damaged by the force of the blast. The U.S. military is being accused of killing as many as 49 Afghan civilians in a pair of separate airstrikes over the weekend. On Sunday, local officials in eastern Afghanistan said a U.S. airstrike killed 27 civilians at a wedding party. The dead included the new bride as well as many women and children. Meanwhile, Afghan President Hamid Karzai has ordered an investigation into a separate U.S. helicopter strike that reportedly killed up to 22 civilians on Friday. The United States military has disputed the accounts of both airstrikes. The Associated Press reports the Justice Department is considering letting the FBI investigate Americans without any evidence of wrongdoing, relying instead partly on racial or ethnic profiling. Currently, FBI agents need specific reasons, such as evidence or allegations that a law probably has been violated, to investigate U.S. citizens and legal residents. The Council on American-Islamic Relations has decried the plan as unconstitutional and un-American. Other critics have compared the proposed guidelines to the FBI's now-defunct COINTELPRO operation under J. Edgar Hoover in the 50s and 60s. Senator Barack Obama has suggested he's willing to refine his campaign promise to remove all combat troops within 16 months of becoming president. On Thursday morning, Senator Obama discussed his views on Iraq in Fargo, North Dakota.
When I go to Iraq and I have a chance to talk to some of the commanders on the ground, I'm sure I'll have more information and we'll continue to refine my policies.
Hours later, Obama held an impromptu press conference to insist his statement did not reflect a change in policy.
That position has not changed. I have not equivocated on that position. I am not searching for maneuvering room with respect to that position.
Meanwhile, Obama has told a Christian magazine he supports a ban on late-term abortions as long as there's an exception for the physical health of the mother. But Obama said mental distress should not qualify as justification for late-term abortions. Obama said, quote, "I don't think that mental distress qualifies as the health of the mother. I think it has to be a serious physical issue that arises in pregnancy where there are real significant problems to the mother carrying that child to term." A Canadian court has sided for the first time with a U.S. war resister who fled to Canada seeking refugee status. Federal Court Justice Richard Barnes ordered the Immigration and Refugee Board to reconsider the failed refugee claim of Joshua Key, who fled to Canada in 2005. Barnes said Key had witnessed enough human rights abuses during a stint in Iraq that he could qualify for asylum. The judge also concluded military action against civilians in Iraq violates the 1949 Geneva Convention. We'll speak with Joshua Key as well as his attorney later in the broadcast. The Guardian newspaper has obtained an unpublished World Bank report that found biofuels have caused world food prices to increase by 75%. The World Bank report was finished in April, but reportedly not published in order to avoid embarrassing the U.S. government, which has claimed plant-derived fuels have pushed up prices by only 3%. The report found biofuels has distorted food markets by diverting grain away from food for fuel, encouraging farmers to set aside land for its production, and sparked financial speculation on grains. A federal judge has ordered Google to turn over information about every user who's ever watched a video on YouTube. The ruling came as part of a lawsuit brought by Viacom over the posting of copyrighted material on YouTube. Google is resisting the request, saying it would allow Viacom to, quote, likely be able to determine the viewing and video uploading habits of YouTube's users. The Electronic Frontier Foundation called the judgment a setback to privacy rights. Leaders from Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, Canada, and the United States are gathering today in Hokkaido, Japan, for the start of the G8 summit. Protests have been occurring for days in the lead-up to the summit. Leaders of indigenous communities have urged wealthy nations to include indigenous people in discussions as they deal with climate change. This is Victoria Tolikorpous, chair of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Rights.
We have contributed the least to climate change, but we are carrying the heavy burden of solving the climate change problem, no? And so we would like them to ensure that we are included in the negotiations of the climate change convention so that we can contribute more substantially in shaping solutions.
On Sunday, the South African-based Global Call to Action Against Poverty held a demonstration in Saipuru. Kumi Naidu urged the G8 nations to help the world's poorest people.
The reality is, in Africa, every single day, 6,000 people die from HIV/AIDS alone. Another 7,000 people die from malaria. Another 2,000-3,000 die from tuberculosis. If those numbers of deaths were happening in Europe or North America, we are convinced the G8 will long time ago have found the money to address these issues. So we want to see the same kind of urgency.
Meanwhile, Japan is being accused of detaining international activists ahead of the G8 summit. On Friday, 20 Korean farmers were detained on the northern island of Hokkaido. Several prominent international critics of the G8 were also blocked from entering Japan, including political scientist Susan George and Ladinda Napoli, the Asia-Pacific coordinator for Jubilee South. On Saturday, at least four people, including a Reuters journalist, were arrested during a heavily policed demonstration in Saipuru. Police were seen shattering the window of a sound truck and dragging out the driver. New questions are being raised over the Colombian military's rescue of kidnapped Colombian politician Ingrid Betancourt and 14 other hostages held by the rebel group FARC. Swiss radio is reporting leaders of the FARC rebel movement were paid $20 million to free the hostages. According to the report, the hostages were actually ransomed for a high price and whole rescue operation was a setup. Colombian officials have denied the report. The Israeli army has announced plans to demolish the home of the family of the Palestinian who killed three Israelis in Jerusalem last week. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem said such a move would be collective punishment and illegal under international law. About 20 people live in the East Jerusalem home. In Somalia, the head of the country's UN development program was shot dead Sunday. It was the latest fatality in a string of attacks on aid workers. Osman Ali Ahmed was shot at close range as he left a mosque in southern Mogadishu. His son was also injured in the shooting. Former North Carolina Republican Senator Jesse Helms has died at the age of 86. During the 1960s, he was a vocal critic of the civil rights movement. He once wrote, quote, "Crime rates and irresponsibility among Negroes are a fact of life which must be faced." In 1983, he opposed the Martin Luther King Day bill. Helms was also a longtime opponent of AIDS research and treatment. In 1988, Helms said, quote, "There is not one single case of AIDS in this country that cannot be traced in origin to sodomy." On foreign affairs, Helms was a supporter of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet and was linked to backing right-wing death squads in El Salvador. In 1996, he co-sponsored the Helms-Burton Act, which strengthened the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Ed Fulner, president of the Heritage Foundation, praised Jesse Helms. He said, quote, along with Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, Helms helped establish the conservative movement and became a powerful voice for free markets and free people. A group of protesters from Code Pink interrupted President Bush's Independence Day ceremony Friday. Bush was speaking at Monticello, the former home of Thomas Jefferson.
Happy 4th of July. I am thrilled to be here at Monticello. I've never been here before.
Impeach Bush!
Shut down the Constitution!
Impeach Bush! War criminal! War criminal! Take him
to my fellow citizens to be, we believe in free speech in the United States of America.
And finally, the Democratic Party is expected to soon announce the site of Senator Barack Obama's nomination acceptance speech is being moved to a larger venue, Invesco Field in Denver, which holds more than 75,000 people. The speech is scheduled for August 28th, the 45th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate is expected to vote on a controversial measure to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for FISA tomorrow. The legislation would rewrite the nation's surveillance laws and authorize the National Security Agency's secret program of warrantless wiretapping. It gives the government new powers to eavesdrop on both domestic and international communications and could also grant immunity to phone companies involved in President Bush's secret domestic spy program. The Democratic-controlled House approved its version of the bill late last month. Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, speaking on Democracy Now!, called the measure, quote, one of the greatest intrusions potentially on the rights of Americans protected under the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution in the history of our country. I'm joined right now by a man who blew the whistle on the involvement of phone companies in the Bush administration's domestic surveillance program. Mark Klein was a technician with AT&T for 22 years, and in 2006, he leaked internal AT&T documents that revealed the company had set up a secret room in its San Francisco office to give the National Security Agency access to its fiber optic internet cables. He testified before Congress last November to urge lawmakers not to give AT&T and other telecom companies immunity. Mark Klein is also a witness in a lawsuit filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which alleges AT&T illegally gave the National Security Agency access to its networks. Mark Klein joins us now from San Francisco, California. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning, Amy.
It's very good to have you with us. This is highly controversial, the vote that is expected to take place tomorrow, especially Senator Obama's role in it. But let's go back to the beginning, Mark Klein. Talk about how you found out about AT&T spying on Americans.
Right. I first should add a correction. Congress never invited me to testify, although I did go to Washington to lobby. But no committee has ever invited me to testify, which says something about Congress. But going back to 2002, we were told one day in late 2002 that an NSA representative was coming to the office to speak to a certain management technician about a special job. And this turned out to be installing a secret room in the next office I was going to be in the following year. And that secret room involved a lot of spying equipment. Only this one management technician could go in there, and the regular union technicians were not allowed to go in there. But when in 2003, I was assigned to that office, and I got hold of the documents, which were available. They're not classified. And the documents showed what they were doing. They were basically copying the entire data stream going across critical internet cables and copying the entire data stream to this secret room. So the NSA was getting everything.
And what was the response when you started to talk about this?
Well, while I was still working at AT&T, I didn't say anything because I wanted to keep my job. And it was a scary atmosphere back then, you may remember. But I sat on it and took some mental notes. And after I retired in 2004, and the end of 2005, when the New York Times came out with their expose that there was warrantless wiretapping going on, then I came forward in early 2006, and I tried to present my documents to some media groups and to some civil liberties groups, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I became a witness in EFF's lawsuit against AT&T. And eventually the media came onto the story. The New York Times came out with a story in April 2006.
Can you talk about the Democratic leadership and Senator Barack Obama, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, of course, of the Democratic Party, calling the bill that's going to be voted on a compromise?
Well, the Democratic Party and the Congress in general has been unfriendly to me for the last 2 years of my efforts. As I say, I've been trying to bring my information forward for about 2 years now. Even after the Congress went Democratic, they turned their back on me, except for a couple of individuals, like Senator Dodd was friendly, and a couple of congressmen. No committee of Congress would invite me to testify. It's never happened. My attorney sent letters, which were never answered, and they voted not to investigate. So it's been clear for some time that Congress wants to help the president cover this up, and they were just looking for a way to do it. And so now they have a bill that claims to get some kind of concessions. In fact, they got no concessions. This bill would give immunity to the phone companies and thus would kill any hope of finding out what happened by the lawsuits against AT&T and the other companies. And so Congress is intervening against the judicial process to kill the lawsuits and essentially protect the president. And it's kind of ironic because you may know the FISA law itself originated when the Democratic Party in Congress discovered that Nixon was trying to spy on Democratic National Committee headquarters in the 70s. And they passed this law to require that any domestic spying must be approved by a secret court, the FISA court. And now the Democratic Party is helping to basically destroy this law. If this bill passes, the law will become a toothless, dead letter, as far as I can tell. The message that will go out is that on paper, the president is not supposed to do this, but everybody knows the president violated the law over and over, and now he's going to get away with it. That's the message if they pass this law, that you can get away with it. We're not going to enforce this law.
I recently interviewed Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. He's been leading the congressional he's the leading congressional voice against the Bush administration's warrantless spy program since it was exposed. I asked him what role telecommunications companies had in rewriting the FISA bill.
Well, they clearly wanted this immunity. They think they should be let off the hook, regardless of what the current laws require. I think, and many of my allies on this think, that the court should decide it based on the law. Sadly, the administration has been very behind the telephone company's desire to have this immunity, maybe even leading the charge, because there's an additional benefit to them if this immunity goes through. It may block our ability to directly challenge in court the violation of the Constitution that the illegal wiretapping program represents. The president takes the position that under Article 2 of the Constitution, he could ignore the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. We believe that that's absolutely wrong. I have pointed out that I think it is not only against the law, but I think it's a pretty plain impeachable offense that the president created this program, and yet this immunity provision may have the effect not only of giving immunity to the telephone companies, but it may also allow the administration to block legal accountability for this crime, which I believe it is.
That was Senator Russ Feingold. Mark Klein, your response.
Yes, Senator Feingold and Senator Dodd have been waging a valiant last-ditch effort to stop this thing. The problem they face is that their own party leadership is against them. This latest bill was rammed through the House by Speaker Pelosi, who had said earlier that she was against immunity, but then she suddenly turned and rammed this through. And the same thing is happening now in the Senate. And Senator Obama, who a few months ago, before he was the nominee, explicitly said he would not vote for any bill that had immunity in it. And now, a few days ago, he's reversed his position and said he will vote for this bill. So the Democratic leadership is overriding the fight that Feingold and Dodd are trying to wage. And they're basically carrying out a secret agreement with the White House. Remember, there were never any open hearings on this. They met in secret with the telephone lobbyists and with intelligence agency officials. It was all a secret deal, a conspiracy against the American people. They never had hearings. I was never invited to any hearings. And they're going to ram this through.
Mark Klein, Eric Lichtblau wrote a piece in the New York Times on Thursday that says a federal judge in California said Wednesday the wiretapping law established by Congress was the exclusive means for the president to eavesdrop on Americans, and he rejected the government's claim that the president's constitutional authority as commander-in-chief trumped that law. The judge is Vaughn Walker, the chief judge in the Northern District of California. He made his findings in a ruling on a lawsuit brought by an Oregon charity. The group says it has evidence of an illegal wiretap used against it by the National Security Agency under the secret surveillance program established by President Bush after September 11th.
Yes, Judge Walker, it's his court where the AT&T case is in now. And he's clearly been unsympathetic to the government's attempts to squash this case. And that's why they went secretly to Congress to squash the case, because they're really afraid of an open court hearing. They don't want an open court hearing. And Judge Walker did a fine ruling, basically arguing that the president had no authority to override FISA. And that's one of three rulings that have happened against the president and against the government. The problem, of course, is that Walker's ruling has no practical effect because the case he was ruling on, the Al Haramain case, cannot go forward because the only piece of evidence they have has been declared a state secret by the government. That's their convenient way of getting rid of evidence, is declare it a state secret. So therefore, it's out of the court. Court can't handle it.
His decision being particularly significant because all the lawsuits involving the telephone companies that took part in the NSA program have been consolidated and are being heard in his case, including the one you're involved with, right, Mark Klein?
That's right. The AT&T case is in his court right now, just waiting the approval to go forward. We're waiting for the Ninth Circuit to give the green light to go forward with the case.
So what does this mean now for you? What does this legislation, if passed by the Senate, mean for that lawsuit?
Well, this legislation will direct the court to dismiss all the cases against AT&T and other companies if they can just show they have a piece of paper showing that they got an order from the president to do this. I call it the Nuremberg defense. We were just following orders. The judge won't be able to rule on whether the order was legal. He can only rule on whether they got this piece of paper. It's a ridiculous ruling, an attempt by the Congress to gag the judge and prevent him from ruling on the legality of the order. And the judge has to simply just determine that their paperwork is in order. So everybody knows if this bill passes, the judge will be forced to dismiss the cases.
And what will this mean in terms of, for example, the AT&T case and in terms of you coming forward as a whistleblower?
Well, I assume the case will just get dismissed, and it'll never happen. I'll never get called. There'll never be any hearings. It'll die, and you'll never find out what they did. And that was the point of having this lawsuit. It wasn't about getting money out of the companies. I wouldn't get anything, by the way. I'm just a witness. I'm not a party to this lawsuit. And it was about finding out what happened. And that's why they want to kill the lawsuit.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mark Klein, for joining us, former technician at AT&T for over 22 years, witness in a lawsuit filed against AT&T by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which alleges AT&T illegally gave the NSA access to its networks. The Senate is expected to vote on the FISA legislation on Tuesday. It would grant retroactive immunity to the phone companies. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
ينحني ويصلي لإله في العيون العسلية بين ردة وعيوني بندقية والذي يعرف ردة ينحني ويصلي لإله في العيون العسلية قبلت ردة عندما كانت صغيرة وأنا أذكر كيف التصقت بي وغطت سعيدي أحلى ضفيرة وأنا قبلت ردة عندما كانت صغيرة وأنا أذكر كيف التصقت بي وغطت سعيدي أحلى ضفيرة وأنا أذكر ردة مثلما يذكر عصفور غديرة آه 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 ردة بيننا نارا عليها بندقية.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to award-winning Palestinian journalist Mohammed Omar, the 24-year-old journalist and photographer from Gaza was physically and psychologically abused by Israeli security official late last month. He is a correspondent for the Interpress Service, was on his way back home after receiving the prestigious Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism in London. Mohammed Omar says he was interrogated, strip-searched, and beaten by 8 armed Shin Bet officials. He was hospitalized for a week after the ordeal. The Shin Bet Security Service issued a response saying Omar, quote, received decent treatment and no extraordinary measures were taken against him. At 24, Omar has seen most of his family killed or wounded. He's the youngest winner of the Martha Gellhorn Award, named after the famous U.S. war correspondent given to journalists who expose establishment propaganda. His award citation reads, quote, every day he reports from a war zone where he's also a prisoner. His homeland, Gaza, is surrounded, starved, attacked, forgotten. He's a profoundly humane witness to one of the great injustices of our time. He's the voice of the voiceless. Mohammed Omar joins me right now on the phone from Gaza. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Can you tell us what happened and when it happened? You were just coming back from London after receiving your award.
Well, let me mention before I start that I'm also writing for the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C. When I was coming back from my award ceremony and also a speaking engagement, I was stopped for nearly 1 hour and a half before an Israeli Shin Bet officer came to me and started collecting my bags, which were securely checked already. I kept waiting for some time until they got my luggage and they start checking everything. The Shabak officer just came to me and then said, you are a crazy man. I just kept it quiet and listened to what he's going to say. And then he said, is there anyone who has been to the Netherlands, to France, to Sweden, to Greece, and to the United Kingdom and come back to Gaza Strip? Gaza is a dirty place. Why do you come back to Gaza? Gaza is a dirty place and people there are dirty. Why do you come to live in such a place where there is no electricity, there is no life, and there is darkness, and there is shortages of fuel, and there is lots of difficulties? Why don't you live in France instead? And I continued to explain to the Shabak officer that I choose to come because I want to come back to Gaza and to be a voice for the voiceless. I want to be the person who gets the message out of the Gaza Strip and to help the world understand what's going on. And then he answered me, okay, Muhammad, then it's your choice. You choose to suffer. I said, not really. I don't choose to suffer. I choose to tell the truth. They started to ask me how much money I have. I told him that I have Jordanian dinar, I have Israeli shekels, and I have euros, and I have also English pounds. He said, put all the money on the table here. I put all the money on the table, and then he said to me, how much Egyptian, how much English pounds you have? I said, I have 480 pounds. And then he said, no, you have more. And then I said, no, I'm not. Then he said, you are a liar. I said, I'm not a liar. All the money I have is here. And then I understood what he is asking about when he was stressing about the English pounds. Then I told him, well, if you are asking about the money that I won from the prize, the Martha Gilham prize, then I don't have them on me now. And they will be sent by bank. Avi took me inside a room where he asked me in an empty room where he asked me, take off your clothes. I told him I'm not going to take off my clothes because I have the Dutch embassy waiting for me outside. After some time, I had to take off my clothes. He said, take off your t-shirt. I take it off. I took off my jeans. I took off my shoes and my socks. And then it's coming to me. He gets closer to me. And then he said, take off your underwear. I said, I'm not going to take off my underwear. There is an embassy waiting outside for me. He said, I know that there is an embassy waiting for you. Take off your underwear. I said, I'm not going to take it off. Then he was putting his hand on his revolver and kept looking at me. Muhammad, take off your underwear, he says. And then I said, I'm not going to take it off because this is a humiliation. You're trying to humiliate me. It's not security checking because I went through the security system like anyone else and you are treating me differently. And then he said, take it off. And then I said, I'm not going to take it off. So he went down to my knees where he pulled down my underwear to make me totally naked. I looked at him and then I told him, okay, so what are you trying to do here? And he said, go right, go left. I said, I'm not going to move right or left. I'm totally naked. And then he started humiliating me and laughing. And I continued explaining to him, why do you treat me that way? I'm a human being and I don't deserve this kind of a treatment. Then he said to me, well, still, you have seen nothing. You will see more. He continued to interrogate me and to continue to search me, stripping and searching me while I was totally naked. And then he told me, go and get your clothes on. I put my clothes on and I went back to the hall where the travelers are coming And then I had all my clothes on, and I found the Shabak agents. They are checking everything. They have collected all the documents that I have in my suitcases. They've collected all the information, my cell phone, my memory cards, my business cards for parliament members I met in the Swedish parliament, in the Dutch parliament, in the Greek parliament, and also they have seen also the House of Commons parliament members that I met. And then he started telling me, oh, you were even on the BBC World Service. I said, of course, I was in the BBC World Service talking about Gaza and the humanitarian situations there. You are at this parliament, at that parliament, you are speaking here, you are speaking there. I said, of course, because he can see all the people I met. He can see all the business cards that I have in there. And then he said that I have only one problem, that I'm talking too much. I said, well, it's my job to talk, and I want that, and it's my choice. I want to get the message out. Then he said to me, if I knew that you would be coming back to Gaza, I wouldn't have let you out in the first place. If I knew that your dream, I thought that your dream is like the other Gazans, young men who get out of Gaza and never come back again. I told him, well, that's not my dream. I want to come back because Gaza is my home, and I want to be a voice for the voiceless. He continued to check everything and every detail, just checking my clothes and every detail, just collecting all the notebooks and all the information and all the brainstorming information and everything that I've got from the parliament. He was making even fun of the parliament members that I met, including House of Commons. Do you think those people are going to help you? He asked, and then I tell him, well, I'm trying to get the message out. I'm not seeking for their help. I'm trying just to inform them about what's happening in Gaza. He starts interrogating, and then he said, why do you bring all these perfumes? I said to him, excuse me, could you do me a favor? Once you check everything in this suitcases, could you please return it as it is? I don't mind you checking it, no problem, but return it as it is. And then he said to me in Hebrew, shake it, which means shut up. And then I said, well, as a journalist, I'm not used to shut up, but I will have to keep it quiet at some point. And then he said, why do you bring these perfumes for? I said, these perfumes are for friends and people I love, and they are just gifts for people that I like. And then he said to me, oh, is love part of your culture as well? I said, of course. And then he continued interrogating, and he saw a trophy from the Union of Greek Journalists. I have received a trophy as a courageous journalist for 2008 from Gaza. And then he said, what's this? I explained that it's a trophy from the Union of Greek Journalists. And then he said to me, Muhammad, you know that Greece is not a friend of Israel? You know that Greece is a friend of the Palestinians? Only the Palestinians and not Israel? I said, well, I don't really care, and that's none of my business. It's a country. I have received an invitation from the parliament in Greece, and I went there to speak after or before I went to collect my prize. I collapsed during the interrogation, fainted and on the ground, and I started vomiting everywhere. And then the soldiers, they started gathering around me. I estimate nearly 1 hour and a half vomiting on the ground. And one of the Shabak officers, I was unconscious for most of the time, but I can remember one of the things that they were doing to me. He was using his nail fingers and benching me all the way, trying to cause me pain under my eyes and under the soft part of my eye. I thought what those people are doing is basically they are trying to torture me. And one of them who was trying to do that, the same thing, benching me using his nail fingers under my ears. And then one other of them who put his shoes on my neck. I could feel actually the outline of his shoes on my neck moving right and left. I started vomiting again and again, especially after one of the soldiers, he had both his two fingers inside the hole between my neck and my chest. There is a little hole, and he put it all the way inside and tried to grab my bones to grab me from my bones different times. That was the most painful thing. And then other one who was trying to put his hands in my chest and all his weight in my chest. It was actually meant to break me and to break my ribs because he put all his weight. And the man who continued, or the soldier who continued to put his feet and his shoes on my neck, that can't be first aid at all. When I told the doctors here in Gaza what happened to me, they say that can't be a first aid and it can't be something like that. That's torture. They continued to do that until one of the soldiers, he dragged me out from my feet and my head on the ground, on the floor, and my back on the floor. He dragged me all the way, taking me into a few meters away, where they start to make fun and they were joking. I could hear they were joking while I was lying down. At that moment, I felt how it feels for a black African man to be under the apartheid system. That's what I felt at that moment. I was unconscious on and off, and suddenly I found that they are taking me in a wheelchair, and they have said that I had nervous breakdown. They take me to an army doctor. I could see the M16 gun with the army doctor who tried to treat me. He tried to install the heart machine to do heart tests on my body. And then he suddenly, and still there is one on the table while I was lying down. He is benching me, trying to torture me in the same way. And I think he is also the same one who was doing the job before. They continued to do it, and after that, I heard the soldiers shouting at each other in Hebrew. And I could hear the English word more than one time, ambulance, 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 after they realized that I am not conscious for some time. And then they transferred me into a Palestinian ambulance for the Red Crescent, where I was taken from there into other place. And then before the ambulance started to move, the ambulance driver and other paramedic, who is a Palestinian guy from Jericho, they had someone knocking at the door of the ambulance, and that is Shabak officer. I think it's Avi, the same soldier who asked me to strip and to take off all my clothes. And then they say, Muhammad, you have to sign on this. I wasn't really totally conscious to know what he wants me to sign on, but he wants me to sign on a paper showing that Shabak and or Shin Bet Israel Security is not responsible in what's happening to me when I leave. I did not sign this because I wasn't conscious, and also the other guys, the ambulance drivers, they say Mohammed is unconscious and he cannot at all do anything or sign any paper. It continued like that until the ambulance driver told them, should I tell the Dutch embassy? They are waiting outside. Should I tell them to follow us and to come to the hospital? Tell them that Mohammed is inside the ambulance. And he told him, listen, it's none of your business. Don't tell the Dutch that Mohammed is in this car. Just take him to the hospital and that's it. Don't tell anybody about what happened. When I was transferred to the hospital, I found myself suddenly in a hospital surrounded by doctors, and that is, I asked them where I am. They say, you are at Jericho Hospital, where I was, the hospital called the embassy, and the embassy came from there to take me, and I was transferred from Jericho to Gaza, where I was transferred to the Gaza European Hospital, where I spent many days having nearly 60 days, 6 days it's been since I was in the hospital.
Mohammed Omar, we just have 2 minutes, and I wanted to ask John Pilger, who gave you the award, a well-known Australian journalist who lives in Britain, a filmmaker, wrote a piece about your treatment and said the former Dutch ambassador, Jan Wijnberg, said, this is by no means an isolated incident, but part of a long-term strategy to demolish Palestinian social, economic, and cultural life. I'm aware of the possibility that Mohammed Omar might be murdered by Israeli snipers or bomb attack in the near future. Again, that was the former Dutch ambassador who said this. Your final comments.
Well, I think this is possible. Once Israel has killed our colleague, the Reuters cameraman, they can kill me. I thought that the fact that I'm being given this international prize is going to bring me protection. But who cares? Israel doesn't care. Israel is trying to provoke the public opinion. They're trying to provoke everybody and trying to torture people and to kill them. I mean, will Israel care to kill a journalist? Of course not. They've killed a family on the beach of Huda Ghalia. 8 family members were killed. They've killed five children who were collecting strawberries 2 years ago, and they continue to kill on daily basis people from day to day. Will they care to kill Mohammed Omar? Of course not.
Mohammed Omar, I want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning Palestinian journalist, just won the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism with Dar Jamal in Britain. Mohammed Omar is the youngest winner of the award. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
To the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a victory for U.S. war resistors, Canada's federal court ruled Friday the Immigration and Refugee Board should reconsider the asylum claim of conscientious objector and Iraq war vet Joshua Key. The court ruled Key had been forced to systematically violate the Geneva Conventions as part of his military service in Iraq and that such misconduct amounts to a legitimate refugee claim. Friday's ruling came a month after the June 3rd parliamentary motion to allow U.S. war resistors and their family members to stay permanently in Canada. The non-binding motion called on the Canadian government to stop all deportation actions against U.S. war resistors in Canada. A recent poll also found a majority of Canadians, 64%, are in favor of granting permanent residence status to conscientious objectors from the United States. As many as 200 U.S. war resistors are currently living in Canada. We're joined now by Iraq war resistor Joshua Key on the phone from Saskatchewan, also the author of The Deserter's Tale, the story of an ordinary soldier who walked away from the war in Iraq. We're also joined in Toronto by Joshua's lawyer, Jeffrey House, who himself was a Vietnam War resistor. And we welcome you as well to Democracy Now!. Starting off with Joshua Key, your response to the Canadian court decision.
It's very hopeful, and I'm glad to see the process go forward. So.
Let me go to Jeffrey House. Jeffrey, can you explain what the decision is? It's not final, but explain exactly its significance.
Well, the federal court accepted the findings of the refugee board that Joshua Key had been ordered by his superior officers to systematically violate the Geneva Conventions in the way in which he and his squad was operating in Iraq. The refugee board, the lower court, had said, okay, he did violate the Geneva Conventions, but he didn't commit war crimes, so he's not a refugee. And the federal court said, no, that's too narrow of an understanding of the right to, of a soldier to refuse improper orders. And they said that if you were ordered to violate the Geneva Conventions on a systematic basis, you have a right to refuse, and any punishment that follows from that refusal will make you a convention refugee and protected by international law.
Now, the decision was to send this case back to a lower court, is that right?
That's right, because there's a question here in Canada, which is whether soldiers face punishment or not. We have argued and have given examples of soldiers who have refused to participate in the Iraq War who are, in fact, punished. But nonetheless, the Federal Court of Appeal here in Canada had said that there's insufficient evidence that soldiers who refuse to serve will be punished by the government of the United States. So in Joshua's case, if there's even a hint that he will face punishment if he's returned to the United States, that would give rise to a refugee claim. However, if he were simply to be discharged and not further used as a soldier, then according to the court decision, he would not be a convention refugee.
Joshua Key, can you tell us about your time in Iraq? What did you tell the court about your experience there?
I told them it was death, destruction, and chaos on our behalf. I've looked at it as many times through my participation in Iraq and dealing with raids, traffic control points, and just civilian killings that you shouldn't have to go back. None of us should have to go back and participate in.
Did you describe particular experiences you had in Iraq? And if you could speak as loud as you can.
There was one incident in Ramadi, my second time there, which I was on a QRF mission. It was like you're the SWAT team for the military for some instance. We were on call for a 24-hour time frame. We got the call late at night, early in the morning. It was we were going on the banks of the Euphrates River. We took a sharp right turn, and on the left-hand side, I seen four decapitated Iraqi bodies. When we parked our armored personnel carrier, I was told to get out to find evidence of a firefight or such have happened. There was this American soldier on the right with American soldiers around him, and he was saying they had lost it there. On the left-hand side, there was American soldiers kicking one of the heads around like a soccer ball. So at that time, I got back inside my APC. The next day, I asked if I could see a written statement or if I could put my, for what I had seen at that location, and I was told it was none of my concern and none of my business. So that's when I started questioning things.
And then what happened? How much longer were you in Iraq?
I was there for still another 2.5 months before I got a two-week leave period, which I went back to Fort Carson, Colorado. At that time, I called a military lawyer and asked him what was my situation, you know, what could I do? I didn't want to go back to Iraq. I was already having symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
Again, Joshua, if you could speak as close to the phone and as loud as you can.
Okay. They said that the lawyer said I had two choices, either go back to Iraq or go to prison. At that time, me and my wife and my children, we made my own decision, and that was to go on the run, which we lived in Philadelphia for 14 months underground until we made the choice to come across to Canada.
There is a case of Corey Glass this week who has a scheduled deportation back to the United States. He's another war resister on July 10th. Jeffrey House, what happens to him now with this decision?
Well, it's not clear that this decision is directly related to him, although it might be that he would want to try to reopen his case in the federal court, because as it happens now, there's a broadened definition of when a person, a soldier, has a right to conscientiously object, not to war in general, but to specific activities of a specific unit that he or she may be in. So it may be possible for Corey Glass to do that. At the same time, the Parliament of Canada has called on the government to just let every soldier in these circumstances stay in Canada if they haven't committed criminal offenses, which no one has. That, I think, is the overriding reality here, that we have the elected representatives of the people of Canada telling the minority government, make something happen for these people. And it's just unfortunate that the government is dragging its feet and considering the issue and probably bending over backwards so that the U.S. administration is not offended. So essentially, that's Corey Glass's position right now. On the one hand, he's got a kind of invitation from the national parliament to stay here, and on the other hand, the administrative procedures are at the last point before actual forced departure to the United States.
I wanted
States.
To go to a clip of Corey Glass. Protests, actions are expected to take place this Wednesday at Canadian consulates in at least 13 cities here in the United States. This is Corey Glass's message to the Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper.
I'm Corey Glass, and I'm an Iraq War veteran. I left the U.S. because of my opposition to the Iraq War. If I'm returned to the U.S., I could face court-martial, jail time, or even redeployment to Iraq. I have not been discharged from the United States military, and I am now currently in the Individual Ready Reserve. The people of Canada support us. A recent poll shows that Canada wants war resisters to stay, and Parliament voted on June 3rd to allow us to stay in Canada. I have lived and worked in Canada for almost 2 years. I hope you will give full consideration to my case and the will of Canadian people, and please stop my deportation before July 10th.
That is war resister Corey Glass in Canada appealing to the Canadian Prime Minister. Jeffrey House, how many war resisters, U.S. war resisters, are there now in Canada? And how does this compare to war resisters in Vietnam, like you?
Well, there's about 200 war resisters here now. And basically, there's little comparison to the later period of Vietnam, in which there were 50,000 people here, mostly draft dodgers like myself, but also some who were deserters. Probably 10 to 15% were military deserters from the Vietnam War. One important thing, though, to remember is that early on in the Vietnam War, there were only a few hundred, and after a long struggle, the doors were forced open here. So prior to 1969, the numbers increased without much possibility, much clear possibility that people would be allowed to stay. But by November of 1969, Mr. Trudeau, the Prime Minister at that time, declared that Canada should be a refuge from militarism. Those were his words. And as a result, the doors opened and people flooded in, people who didn't want to participate in the Vietnam War. So consequently, I look at the numbers as a fluid thing, and it is to some extent kept low by the fact that up to this point, the government of Canada hasn't opened the door. But given that Parliament has done so, given that Parliament has made this recommendation to the government, I think that we may soon be in a situation similar to that when Trudeau made his declaration, and many more people may end up here.
Joshua Key, what would happen if you came back to the United States?
I don't know. I've been told many different things and many different scenarios. You would only know when you were sent back there on what would really happen. So.
And what has been the response of the Canadian people to you taking refuge in Canada?
Oh, from as far as the Canadian people are concerned, it's about 95% positive. Where I live, there's, I don't hear any public objection. I'm sure some people don't approve or believe in what I did, but I look at that as they don't know the circumstances or the case. Most people, if they hear the complete story in detail and they understand, then it's not, there's no questions.
Would you want to come back to the United States if you were not punished?
Well, I'd love to come back to my home. That's where my family lives. That's where my kids, grandparents, and their family lives. I mean, that'll always be home. And I've never had an objection with the American people. It's always been with the government. So I love America.
Josh O'Keefe, will leave it there. Iraq war resistor, a private in the U.S. Army, deployed to Iraq in 2003. Thank you very much, Jeffrey House, lawyer for Josh O'Keefe, speaking to us from Toronto. And that does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fotokadusar, Mate Angeli Comet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hany Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Peter Curries, our engineers. Special thanks also to Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, Jay Salnour, John Randolph, Kieran Kugmedos, Rakan Penny, Vesta Gadars, and happy birthday to Laura Chipley. Our website is democracynow.org. You can sign up there for our headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.